The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
Maybe the most sublime thing ever written. So spake our mother Eve, and Adam heard, well pleased, but answered not, for now too nigh the archangels stood, and from the other hill to their fixed station, all in bright array, the cherubim descended, on the ground gliding meteorous. As evening mist risen from a river over the marsh glides and gathers ground fast at the laborer's heel, homeward returning. High in front advanced the brandished sword of God, before them blazed fierce as a comet, which with torrid heat and vapor as the Libyan air adust, began to parch that temperate clime. Or at an either hand the hastening angel caught our lingering parents, and to the eastern gate led them direct, and down the cliff as fast to the subjected plain, then disappeared. You understand what's happening. Adam and Eve, at the end of Paradise Lost, are being kicked out of the Garden of Eden. And Michael the Archangel takes them by the hand and takes them out of this perfect climate, this perfect place, this perfect, perfect Eden, and leads them by the hand into a desert. And then vanishes. And there they stand, broken and fallen, in an unending sea of hot, dry sand. They, looking back, all the eastern side beheld of paradise, so late their happy seat, waved over by that flaming brand, the gate with dreadful faces thronged and fiery arms. They look back to Eden because, well, that's all we've ever done since we lost it, is to look back, wishing that we still had it, and doing everything we can to recreate it here. But that first looking back, Adam and Eve see this flaming sword waved by Michael the Archangel, and the gate has now been filled with these burning faces of cherubim saying, don't even think about trying to get back in. Paradise has been lost. Some natural tears they dropped, but wiped them soon. The world was all before them, where to choose their place of rest, and Providence their guide. They, hand in hand, with wandering steps and slow, through Eden took their solitary way. Now, when people find out that you're a rock climber, they usually just think you're a little crazy. When they find out that you're into big wall climbing and high altitude mountaineering, all doubt is removed. Right? This is what I look like with a full down bodysuit, full Gore-Tex bodysuit, four layers underneath of that at 14,000 feet and 95 mile an hour winds at 17 degrees below zero. And I'm having a great time, because the experience is sublime. Mountaineers go places that normal, sane people with actual lives never get to go and to see. I'm going to start off talking with you about this sublime today by giving you a little bit of my own experience of what that is like in the world of climbing. How many of you have been to Yosemite Valley before? Probably at least a couple of you have traveled out to California. Maybe you're from California. And John Muir called this the sublime valley, the incomparable valley. There really is nothing like Yosemite Valley anywhere on Earth. There are taller mountains and there are a lot of big cliffs around, but when you come into Yosemite Valley and you drive on Route 41 and you come through the Wawona Tunnel, you come around this bend and all of a sudden you haven't seen it at all on the drive up, and all of a sudden the whole thing just unfolds in front of you. It's about 4 hours north of my house in Los Angeles. It's kind of in the central part of the western slope of the High Sierra. And you come around the bend and you're just like, well, that can't be real. That has to be a painting. That can't possibly be real. How can anything look like, how big is that waterfall? The waterfall on the right is pretty big. How big is that cliff, Half Dome, all the way in the back, poking up in the clouds? And what about this big cliff on the left? And so to give you a little bit of perspective, that red thing right there, that would be the size of the Empire State Building. That little blue thing right there, that's the size of the little building we're in right now. And the cliff on the left, El Capitan, is the largest exposed vertical granite, perfectly clean granite wall in the world, is about 3,000 feet tall vertically. If you were to stand at the top of El Capitan, or if you were to climb the face and then drop a carabiner off, which climbers sometimes do, this is why you don't spend any time walking around the base of it, because they do drop things, it would take 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 seconds before it hit the ground at terminal velocity, 126 feet per second at that point. It's a really big cliff. The first time it was climbed, 1958, it took a year and a half of continual efforts and 48 days of three guys working their way slowly up the wall. National Park Service finally said, all right, get off there. You're causing traffic jams to the tourists, right? People would drive into Yosemite, and no one in their right mind would climb something like that. It's absolutely smooth, dead vertical and overhanging for, you know, over 10 football fields high, right? This is what it looks like from the base. It is completely overwhelming and terrifying. Most climbers who kind of at the height of their climbing career get the crazy guts enough, I think I'm going to try to climb El Capitan. They walk to the base, look up, and turn around and walk away because it's absolutely overwhelming. Climbers actually get lost on El Capitan. I once yelled over at a team of Koreans, six Koreans, who had a little guidebook open, and they'd been on the wall for 6 days, and they were running out of water, and they weren't even halfway up, and I said, go down. You're going to die. You don't want to do that. Just to give you an idea of the scale, the photograph on the left, you can see red arrows pointing to small groups of climbers working up the wall. That photograph is proportional to the small red block on the right side photo. That's how big. You can actually get lost. Well, we've been in the wrong crack system for 3 days. We're going to die now. This is not really good. Okay. This is what it looks from about halfway up. That's me kind of in the center of the photograph in the little dark area. Those things that look like little bits of grass and brush at the bottom, those are Ticonderoga pine trees that are 150 feet tall. Okay. Here's what it looks like. About half to two-thirds of the way up there. It's a little scary, right, for some people. That's me climbing around this gigantic overhang at the 2,200 foot rate. Most climbers take 3 to 7 days to climb El Capitan. Some climbs take a week and a half. You're up there the entire time, you bring all your gear. But there's a couple of us that are particularly crazy that do big wall speed climbing, about 50 or 60 of us. And our goal is to always try and climb it under 24 hours, to do it in one day. And I've actually done that 4 times, and my wife has not divorced me yet. That's not really biblical grounds for divorce. This is what it looks like when a storm comes in about halfway up. That's kind of scary. It's overwhelmingly terrifying. People are like, aren't you afraid? Yes, I'm afraid. I still like it, though. Aren't you afraid of falling? No, only of landing. Right. Okay. Here's what it looks like about three quarters of the way up. That's me coming up the wall. You can see all the way down to the very base of the route. It's about 2,700 feet up at this point. And then the right-hand photograph is me leading the last pitch, the last rope length of the climb up this little finger crack. This is dead vertical, and then those two things up at the top of the photograph are overhangs that stick out about 15 or 18 feet. We're kind of climbing over the ascending. And you finally pull over the lip, and that's what you see. It's a kind of a disorienting photograph, isn't it? You're like, wait, what's all that expensive REI climbing gear on the left? And what's, oh. And you start to get vertigo when you realize just how terrifying something like this is. And I'm not really into selfies, even though I live in L.A., but I took one pulling over the lip. You know, I've been up about 17 hours straight and climbing the whole time, a little bit tired. That's what it looks like looking straight down through. Again, if you drop a carabiner at that point, it will fall for well over 10 seconds and it will land right at the base. It's absolutely terrifying. So why would I do it? Because there's a certain power in terror. And that power is what several very important thinkers that you may not be familiar with call the sublime. I'm going to talk with you today about two different thinkers, an ancient Greek philosopher named Longinus, and then an 18th century British guy named Edmund Burke. You may be familiar with Edmund Burke. He's kind of known as the father of what we would call Tory thought or conservative thought, just general cultural conservatism. So we're going to talk about what the sublime is. And people use this phrase all the time, you know, like they're eating, you know, ice cream, like, oh, that's sublime. Yeah, it might be good ice cream, but it's not sublime. Sublime has a very particular kind of meaning in aesthetic theory. And that's what I want to talk to you about today, because using the sublime, understanding how to give your students the experience of the sublime, is one of the most powerful pedagogical tools that you will ever develop. If you're a classical educator, you're doing what you do for the money and because you love it. Now, probably just because you love it, right? Because you've read Hamlet and you know how powerful it is. You've read Aristotle. You've read Plato. You've perhaps read Sophocles' Oedipus Rex. You've read Virgil. You've read Ovid. Maybe you really love Mary Shelley. Maybe you prefer Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights. Or maybe you're a musician and you know just how incredibly powerful Puccini is. Right? Or Mozart, or Beethoven, or Bach, right? Or you're a mathematician, and you know how beautiful numbers are, and how fabulous formulas are. Or maybe you're a physicist, or a chemist, or maybe you're an administrator, and you know how beautiful faculty members are. You understand the sublime, even if you can't put your finger on it, can't give words to it. And that's really what I want to talk with you about today. So we're going to start with Longinus. You can follow along in your little outline here with me. Longinus writes this book sometime, we don't really know exactly when, sometime between the 1st and the 3rd century A.D. And the Periopsis, his book on the sublime, or about the sublime, is one of the earliest treatises on literary criticism, rhetoric particularly, and the idea of the sublime. And so he's the first person that really defines what the sublime is and tries to talk about how it works. And he's mostly using examples from literature because he's particularly interested in rhetoric. And so here is one of the famous quotes from the opening of On the Sublime. On the Sublime is not long. You can find it in a number of good translations. You can find e-texts on the internet that are good translations from the Hellenistic Greek that he uses to compose his work. And here's what he says. This is kind of the famous opening of the book where he defines what the sublime is. But you can't really define the sublime. All you can do is describe to some limited degree what its effects are. He says, the effect of elevated language upon an audience is not persuasion, but transport. Now, he's talking here particularly about rhetoric and elevated language. A lot of his argument comes from, or at least is related to, Aristotle's rhetoric. But and his work is laden with all kinds of quotes, literary examples. Of course, he quotes Homer all the time because Homer is sublime. He quotes any of a number of classical Greek and Latin orators. He loves little sentences like "Veni, vidi, vici."
Or if you're a Latin purist, wendy, weedy, weaky. But then it sounds like I came, I saw, I looked it up on Wikipedia. It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense, right? Okay. But it's this perfectly balanced three-word Latin sentence with the assonance of vu, and the vu, and the vu, and then the I, and the I, and the I at the end, and the consonants in the middle, I came, I saw, I conquered, right? Ascendaton, there's no conjunctions. And it's a perfect, perfect sentence from Caesar, right? It's not designed to persuade you. It's not what most people think of rhetoric, right? Aristotle's famous definition of rhetoric in the opening of his rhetoric is the study of all available means of persuasion. It's that the sublime, truly sublime rhetoric doesn't persuade through logic and ethos and so on and so forth. It's not simply that it persuades you because it's able to be persuasive. It's that it transports you. It takes you out of yourself. How many of you have ever read a book and while you're reading the book, it took you out of yourself? Yeah, probably everybody in this room. That's why you're here. Right? Whether it's a literary book or a science book, when you read something that's so beautiful and it's talking beautifully about beautiful things and it transports you out of this world into another more beautiful realm. This is why the powerful writers are referred to as sublime. They create an entire world of words, like a Tolkien or a Lewis or a modern pop writer like Stephen King, who some people will call a hack, but he's a great storyteller. I'm not particularly a huge fan. I don't read a lot of his stuff or anything, but he's a very good storyteller, and it takes you out of yourself, and that's what transport means. You are transported out of yourself. At every time and in every way, imposing speech, memorable speech we would probably say, with a spell it throws over us, prevails over that which aims at persuasion and gratification. Our persuasions we can usually control. Yeah, you know, I know what he's saying is true, I just reject it. But the influences of the sublime bring power and irresistible might to bear and reign supreme over every hearer. Right? Longinus starts off talking about the power of the sublime in nature. Waterfalls, huge waterfalls, the ocean, the mountains, the desert, fog rolling in, the power of the stars in the sky at night, what a full moon looks like rising over a forest. And then he says, there's all kinds of other forms of sublime. Nature is sublime, but rhetoric can be sublime, literature can be sublime, art can be sublime. You ever seen a movie that took you completely out of yourself? How many of you, after you watch Braveheart, do not speak in a Scottish accent for the next 72 hours? They go, I'm looking for Englishmen to freaking kill. Right? Yeah! Everybody does that. Right? I mean, when I was 13 years old and Star Wars came out, I walked around school for about a month going, you know, looking at the fourth graders, terrifying them, you know. We can usually control our persuasions, but the influence of the sublime bring power and irresistible might to bear. It's like a tidal wave that carries you. And it reigns supreme over every hearer. Similarly, we see skill in invention and due order and arrangement of matter. If you know the five Ciceronian Quintilianic canons of rhetoric, that's what he's talking about there. Yeah, you can be skillful in your invention and your order and your arrangement. How many of you have heard a perfectly delivered, you know, five part or maybe the seven part if you do it that way, rhetorical speech, and it did not transport you? It can be perfectly constructed and not transport. Emerging is the hard won result, not of one thing nor of two. It's not the parts, but of the whole texture of the composition. So you can have the whole thing put together and it can be persuasive, but it won't be sublime. It won't transport. Whereas, and then here's the great quote, sublimity, flashing forth at the right moment, scatters everything before it like a thunderbolt. And everything for an instant becomes absolutely crystal clear, and you're terrified because lightning is scary. That's what sublimity is. I remember the first time I read Hamlet, I was a sophomore in college, and I leaned back in my chair. I read the whole thing straight through in one sitting, and I'd only read three or four Shakespeare plays. I didn't understand a line of Hamlet, but it was still sublime and had its effect. And I leaned back so far on my chair that the chair tipped over, and I just laid there. My wife came, what's going on? You know, and I'm laying there going, I don't know what's going on. And I didn't even bother getting up. How do you get up after Hamlet? You know, my wife said, good night, sweet prince, all that kind of stuff. It scatters everything before it like a thunderbolt and at once displays the power of the orator in all its plenitude. That's powerful rhetoric. And as I said, Longinus talks about how nature as well as art, as well as human artifice, will sometimes flash forth. Here's this wonderful line. He says, sublimity is the echo of a great soul. So a great rhetorical speech or a fabulous novel or a beautiful poem or a marvelous epic. Those things are great because they are the echo of a great soul. This is part of Milton's theology of poetics was, in order to produce a great poem, you had to be a great poet. You had to be a great man, a great person. Right? Well, if you take a look at the world of nature, I think it's very obvious from just observation as well as scripture, that the sublimity of nature is the echo of the great soul of its creator, right? I mean, that's Psalm 104 and basically the rest of the Bible as well, right? Off to the left here, that's sunset on Mount Everest, the dark one on the left, and Nuptse on the right. I've got a friend who's summited Mount Everest 4 times. I would never do anything that crazy. Yosemite Falls with a beautiful rain. Wait, Yosemite Falls is 1.5 Empire State Buildings tall, and that's just the top part of the waterfall. It drops another 1,500 feet from what the rainbow is in a series of cascades several hundred feet tall. You know what that is? That is the largest shadow in the world. This was taken from the summit of Mount Everest at sunset, and that triangular darkness you see is the shadow of Mount Everest running 650 miles out to the edge of the visible horizon from 29,028 feet. The shadow is so large at this point, the sun almost behind you on the horizon, that the shadow is now moving up into the space of the air above the horizon. That is sublime. It transports you out of yourself. You think, how in the world? It's a moon, just as it touches the horizon on the sea at night. You've probably seen this. It's the most famous photograph taken by the Hubble telescope. This is called the Pillars of Creation. It's a massive, and I mean massive, dust cloud somewhere out there in deep space. It's incredibly beautiful. But not only is it beautiful, its massivity goes beyond our ability to comprehend. The smallest little tiny finger of dust cloud that you see up at the very top of the left-hand pillar, that little thing that goes up like this, okay, our solar system would fit inside of that 10 times. God just spoke it into existence. That is sublime. The more we perfect our instruments of looking close at things that are tiny, and looking from a distance at things that are huge and far away, the more evidence we gather that this could not possibly have just happened. Not because it's huge, not because it's complex, that's part of the equation, but because it's so beautiful. It is sublime. It transports you out of yourself. You see something like that, you stand at the edge of the Grand Canyon, and you are struck dumb. In book 9, chapter 9 of On the Sublime, Longinus brings this very interesting source in after talking about Aristotle and Homer and Sophocles and nature and art. He says, and there's another example of something that's incredibly sublime. A similar effect was achieved by the lawgiver of the Jews. Now, this is a Greek guy in the first century, a pagan. No mean genius. And, that lawgiver of the Jews, who's he talking about? It's Moses. This guy, somehow or another, got a hold of, apparently, a Septuagint. Probably didn't read Hebrew. And read it. And he was struck by the opening. No mean genius, for he both understood and gave expression to the power of the divinity as it deserved when he wrote at the very beginning of his laws, and I quote his words, God said, what was it? Let there be light, and there was. Let there be earth, and there was. Even pagans recognize that there's no text like this text because it's divine. It goes beyond sublime. No human could write that. So that's a little bit of an overview of the ancient idea of the sublime. Let's move up into the 18th century, right? This is kind of in the period that moves us towards English Romanticism. Burke is kind of coming out of a kind of an English philosophical neoclassical tradition, but his ideas had a tremendous influence on the romantic poets, Blake and Shelley and Keats and Byron and all those guys. Edmund Burke in 1757 publishes this. Here's the first edition, a philosophical inquiry into the origin of our ideas of the sublime and beautiful. They were not very good at short titles in the 18th century. Some editions have a subtitle after it, which I don't have enough time to read to you. And some have subtitles. Like, they're longer than most books that I write. Okay. And Burke has some very, very interesting ideas. It's somewhat different than from Longinus. He talks about two categories, the beautiful and the sublime. He says the beautiful is anything that is perfectly formed and aesthetically pleasing. Basically, the idea is that it's something that attracts. Oh, she's so attractive to me. Why? Well, she's so beautiful. Why is she beautiful? Well, because she's attractive. Right? Okay. And we think of something like the David. I have lost count of how many times that I've been in Florence and I take people around the corner and I say, don't look, don't look, don't look. And as you move down the hallway, it's only about 250 feet, you move down the hallway, there are five statues, three on this side, two on this side, and they are they're the incomplete, they're the incomplete. They're Michelangelo's huge, there's like a prisoner, and he's trying to escape out of this stone. But they're incomplete, you know. You can see an arm, but you can't see a head. You can see a leg and a chest, and it's perfectly polished, but the rest of it is still encased in the stone. And then, after you go by those five, you turn around, and there's David looking at you. And you cannot, at that point, turn around and walk out of the Galleria dell'Accademia. You cannot do it. It draws you forth like steel filings to a magnet. And you walk up and you walk around and you can't stop. How did anybody do that? You know that the David was Michelangelo's first major work? Did you know that? He's about 23 years old. 23. Whatever you're doing now in your life, just quit. Because you will never, ever, ever... Right? And it is sublime. People think art, they think Michelangelo's David. Right? We're going to look at it in a few minutes. So, the aesthetically pleasing, the beautiful is something that attracts you. But the sublime moves beyond that. The David is not merely beautiful. It is beautiful. But it is not merely beautiful. It is sublime. It is compelling. And it is able, according to Burke, to overwhelm and even destroy you. Right? This is why the Romantic poets were so fascinated with the Alps. They didn't climb up in them, but they stood at the base and they would look up and go, that is terrifying. Mountaineering wasn't even invented until about the 1860s or 70s. The sublime brings you into the presence of the infinite, and it creates a sensation of awe. And then Burke makes a distinction between two different kinds of effect that the sublime will bring to you. So if something is beautiful, like, oh, that's beautiful. But if something is sublime, you are filled with terror and or horror. So terror would be this, well, he kind of defines it. Terror is characterized by obscurity or indeterminacy. You just don't understand it. How can a waterfall be that big? How can Angel Falls drop 3,000 feet in Venezuela? How could Mount Everest be that huge? How could the ocean go on and then just curve around to Asia? How can it do that? How can space be so infinite? How is it that when I look up into the stars at night, I'm not just looking at the stars as they are right now, I'm seeing the stars as they were, because it takes the light a little bit of time to travel there. So you realize, when you look up into the stars at night, you are looking into the past. Not only that, you're not looking into the past, you're looking into the pasts, because not all the stars are the same distance away. Some of the stars you're seeing are how they looked a lot earlier than other stars. You are looking into infinite, multiple pasts. And when they train those things like the Hubble telescope, they found this dark zone. They just called it the dark zone, right? Well, let's keep zooming in and zooming in and zooming in because there's no stars there. It's like a blank, infinite blank. It just goes out. We found a little hole in the universe. It goes, 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 goes. And they kept zooming in and zooming in and resolving and resolving and computer enhancement. And finally, they saw a little speck. Oh, there's a little star out there. And they kept zooming and zooming and zooming and zooming and zooming. And suddenly realized, no, that's a galaxy. And they kept zooming and zooming and zooming and realized it was a cluster of hundreds of galaxies. Hundreds of galaxies, much bigger than the Milky Way. That is a kind of terror, how small we are. And so Burke calls this the dread of anticipation, right? It's in a scary movie. When you know that the guy with the hockey mask and the chainsaw is up in the closet upstairs, and some teenage girl always goes, oh, I'll look for my friends in this haunted house, and wander through the house and like... right? It's when you hear John Williams score in Jaws, da-dum-da-dum-da-da, and the camera's underwater, like, where's the shark? Where's the shark? Where's the shark? Right? That's terror. It's dread. Right? It's the indeterminacy that leads the reader towards the sublime. You keep flipping the pages in Frankenstein. What's going to happen next? But horror is something different. Right? It's a paralysis in presence. Right? Horror, in contrast, it nearly annihilates the reader's responsive capacity with its unambiguous displays of atrocity. Terror is when you're afraid, what's it going to happen? And horror is, it's happening! Right? So the example that I give when I teach this to my students is, terror is, you're standing, and you can do this, at the edge of the rock, and the river is rushing here, and it drops over Yosemite Falls. That's terror. It's like, what if I slipped and fell in? Horror is, whoops, I slipped and fell in, and I'm being carried over the falls. So Burke says, because he's very Aristotelian, he says there are the four kind of classical Aristotelian causalities of beauty. The formal cause of beauty is love. And the material cause is pleasant, attractive aspects of the object of love. And the efficient cause is the calming of our soul. Oh, it's so beautiful. I just don't want to leave. Florence is so beautiful. I just don't want to leave. I've had students in tears when I said, time to say goodbye to Florence, and we're going to get on the plane. No, I don't want to leave. It's so beautiful. I've got to go back to Los Angeles. Woo! The final cause is God's providence. A very interesting kind of theological perspective. God's providence, God's control over the world, is what makes some things beautiful and makes us attracted to them. But he, differently than Longinus, says it's not proportion, and it's not decorum, and it's not perfection like you see in classical aesthetics. It's God controlling our perception of something that is beautiful, that attracts us to it. He also says that there are four Aristotelian causes of the sublime, and this is somewhat different. The formal cause is the passion of fear, particularly the fear of death. The fear of death. The material cause would be aspects of certain objects such as vastness, infinity, magnificence, etc. Sitting in your garden in your backyard, no matter how beautiful it is, it's not sublime. But going into a deep old growth forest is. Walking up a little hill is not sublime. But going up into the high mountains is sublime. Fishing in a cute little green bass pond is not sublime. But standing at the edge of the sea is sublime. This is where the continent ends and the sea begins. I am at this border, this liminal space. Land, land, sea. Land, sea. And I'm right there. And that is sublime. Right. Efficient cause, at least according to Burke, is what he calls the tension of our nerves. And by nerves, he really means our conscious experience, what we might even call our soul. And the final cause, this is where it gets very strange, is God having created and battled Satan and evil. What actually causes the sublime is this inner sense that God has won out over evil, and the good and the true and the beautiful in the end wins. God wins, right? Despite whatever your eschatology is, if you're a believer of whatever stripe, whatever your eschatology is, you're Reformed, all-mill, post-mill, post-trib, pre-mill, you know, blah, 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 whatever you are, we all share the same ultimate basic eschatology, which is God wins. In the end, God wins. Right? And so he says that the sublime is powerful and vast and magnificent, and it's obscure. It's, you can't consciously compute the whole thing. It's too much. It's too big. It's too terrifying. And he says it's also deadly. It's deadly. And then he gives this example. And because Burke is brilliant, his example is from Milton. This is from the end of book two. He goes right from that quote I just gave you to the end of book two, where the reader sees Satan coming to the gates of hell to escape and go out and wreak havoc on Adam and Eve and all their descendants in the Garden of Eden. And Satan meets this weird kind of monstrous woman who's half snake, half woman, and she's sin. And she has an incestuous son with Satan, and that incestuous son, who's both Satan's son and grandson, is death. And he describes death, right? And Milton gets this right out of the first chapter of James, right? That's the genealogy. The imagery comes from Spencer's Fairy Queen, book one, canto one. But the imagery is, right, is that sin, when it has conceived, brings forth death. So Satan and his daughter, Sin, have an incestuous sexual relationship, and the product is this monstrous figure of death. But death has no form. He's described as just a shadow. So how do you draw a shadow? How do you sculpt the shadow? How do you describe in poetry a shadow? So he says, the other shape. So you've got Satan, sin, and death. It's the unholy trinity, by the way. Satan, sin, and death. They mock the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Satan, sin, and death. The other shape, by the way, that's line 666 in book 2. The other shape, death. If shape, it might be called that shape had none. So it's a shapeless shape. It's a big bag of nothing and everything. It has no shape. It has no form. You can't grasp it. You can't. There's no outline. There's no border to it. If shape, it might be called that shape had none, distinguishable in member, joint, or limb, or substance might be called that shadow seemed, for each seemed either black he stood as night, fierce as 10 furies, terrible as hell, and shook a deadly dart. In the 17th century, a dart is a deadly spear. It's not like, ooh, let's play darts in a British pub, right? He's got this spear, he's death. What seemed his head, it only seems to be his head because he has no real form, the likeness of a kingly crown had on, because after the fall, death rules, right? Death rules from Adam on. And that's Burke's example of something that is sublime. Right? He says, the passion caused by the great and sublime in nature, when those causes operate most powerfully, is astonishment. Like, oh! Right? And astonishment is that state of the soul. Astonishment, etymologically, goes back into a very early Middle English word, astonied, which means turned to stone. Not stoned, turned to stone. An astonishment is that state of the soul in which all of its motions are suspended with some degree of horror, right? You're overwhelmed in the presence of something that is absolutely sublime. You come around the corner and you just turn to stone. In this case, the mind is so entirely filled with this object that it cannot entertain any other. You can't think of anything else. No one stands in front of the David, in front of the sea, and goes, I've got to check my stock options right now on my phone here. No one in their right mind does that. You cannot entertain any other, nor by consequence reason on that object which employs. Whenever people stand in front of the David or some great work of art and they start doing that intellectual talk.
But you know, in 1501, when David Oxford began to be carved by Michelangelo Buonarroti, he was born here in Florence, blah, 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 and he's 16 feet tall and weighs approximately 11 tons. I'm like, shut up!
You don't analyze, you don't measure, you don't talk, you don't give the historical background. Buy the pamphlet or the book and find out later. You just look. You are turned to stone in the presence of Michelangelo's David. Right. Hence arises the great power of the sublime, that far from being produced by them, it's not the experience of the sublime is not produced by reasonings. And that's what we're going to go in a few minutes as we start to look at some art about the pedagogical power of experiencing the sublime. You don't say, all right, kids, now we're going to talk about the sublime, and I'm going to give you a lot of details. Sorry, I'm doing that now, but this is an academic conference, right? So, right, well, you don't say, we're going to see something sublime, now let's talk about the artist, and let's talk about the form, and let's see where this neoclassical or romanticist or whatever. You don't do that. You just say, look at this. You just put it there, and it will do the work. It is not reasoning. It's not primarily intellectual. And it hurries us on by an irresistible force. Astonishment, as I have said, is the effect of the sublime in its highest degree. The inferior effects are admiration, reverence, and respect. Yeah, oh yeah, I admire the Mona Lisa. Oh yeah, you know, I've got a lot of reference for Caravaggio's 17th century Baroque mannerist paintings. And yeah, I really respect Jackson Pollock. No. It transports you, it carries you out of yourself. And its primary effect is disorientation. Disorientation, right? Think about the truth about what God has made. And think about how in our fallen state, we are disoriented. We cannot read the book of the world properly. Well, look at the evidence. Clearly we evolved from lower forms of life. No, some of you just still are lower forms of life because you don't know what you are, right? Your students can experience disorientation in the face of the beautiful. And that's very effective. You should show your students beautiful things. Have them listen to beautiful things. Have them experience and touch and feel and walk around beautiful things, both in the natural world and in the world of human cultural production.
But your students can also experience, and we can experience disorientation in the sublime through terror and through horror. And this doesn't mean have them read Stephen King novels, although I teach a Gothic course, and one of the people that we read is Stephen King. Disorientation is a very powerful, very effective tool, right? Imagine if you suddenly became aware of the fact that you had been created by a man as a science project in college, a guy named Victor Frankenstein, right? Not Dr. Frankenstein. He was an undergraduate student, for crying out loud. He doesn't have a doctorate, not yet, right? Okay. Here's poor Robert De Niro in some kind of a horrible, you know, probably took 10 hours to put on makeup suit, and he's all sewn together, and Kenneth Branagh goes like, oh, I made you. Wait, you were supposed to be good looking. I tried to make Robert De Niro, but I have Robert De Niro in this horrible makeup outfit, and you've covered this weird embryonic fluid in this, you know, film about Frankenstein. How many of you have read Mary Shelley's Frankenstein? Like, one of the greatest novels ever written. It was the first novel, and it was written by a teenage girl. That's sublime. Here's the passage. If you've read it, you remember this passage because it's absolutely sublime. It was on a dreary night of November that I beheld the accomplishment of my toils. With an anxiety that almost amounted to agony, I collected the instruments of life around me that I might infuse a spark of being into the lifeless thing at my feet. It was already 1 in the morning. The rain pattered dismally against the panes and my candle was nearly burnt out. When, by the glimmer of the half-extinguished light, I saw the dull yellow eye of the creature open. You remember that line? It's unforgettable. The dull yellow light. It opens. It breathed hard. And a convulsive motion agitated its limbs. How can I describe my emotions at this catastrophe? Or how delineate the wretch whom with such infinite pains and care I had endeavored to form? His limbs were in proportion, and I had selected his features as beautiful. You know, I went to the charnel houses and the cemeteries, and they chopped up. Oh, it's a good-looking guy. I think that he's got a nice arm. Oh, nice glute over here. Oh, yeah, I got like a little mustache. I'll cut that off and sew it over. He's designing the perfect human being. His limbs were in proportion, and I had selected his features as beautiful. Remember the next line? Beautiful! Great God! His yellow skin scarcely covered the work of muscles and arteries beneath. His hair was of a lustrous black and flowing. His teeth of a pearly whiteness. But these luxuriances only formed a more horrid contrast with his watery eyes that seemed almost of the same color as the dun white sockets in which they were set. His shriveled complexion and straight black lips. Looks like a member of a goth metal band, you know. Victor is horrified at the thing he's made in the same way that Mary Shelley was horrified at the creation of her novels. She writes about it in her journals. Like, you know, I gave monstrous birth to my story, is what she says. Do you remember what happens next, the next paragraph? It's absolutely gripping. It's sublime beyond belief. Because she goes to one of the most sublime experiences you can have, which is dreaming. Talk about being transported out of yourself. Right? Your mind puts on a little crazy show for yourself in your mind while you're asleep. I had this weird dream right before I woke up this morning, and all the people at the conference were on this train, and we were all happy and singing, and other people were crying, and we were being taken to a place where we're all being slowly hung. I have no idea what that means. And my alarm went off right before they put the noose around my head. I have no idea if that has to do with doing this talk or anything like that. But anyways, there it is. She says, the different accidents of life are not so changeable as the feelings of human nature. I had worked hard for nearly 2 years for the sole purpose of infusing life into an inanimate body. For this, I had deprived myself of rest and health. I had desired it with an ardor that far exceeded moderation. But now that I had finished, the beauty of the dream vanished, and breathless horror and disgust filled my heart. I mean, this girl's 19 years old. You know, most 19-year-old girls that I know in L.A. are all day long. Oh, update my Instagram. You know, that's all they do. And she's writing a novel that is unforgettable. Not on a cell phone either. Unable to endure the aspect of the being I had created. And Mary later said, that's how I felt about my novel. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't stand it. It was so horrible. At first, people thought there was no way that any female, much less a very young female, could have written somebody. It had to be written by a man.
Unable to endure the aspect of the being I had created, I rushed out of the room and continued a long time traversing my bedchamber, unable to compose my mind to sleep. At length, lassitude succeeded to the tumult I had before endured, and I threw myself on the bed in my clothes, endeavoring to seek a few moments of forgetfulness. Fear my talk yesterday about forgetfulness. That'll ring a bell. But it was in vain. Remember her dream? It's unforgettable. It was in vain. I slept indeed, but I was disturbed by the wildest dreams. I thought I saw Elizabeth. Now, this is kind of like a close relative of his that he's in love with and is going to marry. That's a little weird. So he sees his fiancée, his love. I thought I saw Elizabeth in the bloom of health, walking in the streets of Ingolstadt, which is where they're from. Delighted and surprised, I embraced her. But as I imprinted the first kiss on her lips, they became livid with the hue of death. His lover is a corpse. Ew. Her features appeared to change. Elizabeth turns into something else. Remember what she turns into? Her features appeared to change, and I thought that I held the corpse of my dead mother in my arms. A shroud enveloped her form, and I saw the grave worms crawling in the folds of the flannel. I started from my sleep with horror. Well, yeah! You know, your lover becomes a corpse, and then your lover becomes your mother lover. That's way too Sophoclean for most of us to handle, right? It's absolutely terrifying. And then it gets worse when he wakes up. If he wakes up, Dorothy, wake up. I started from my sleep with horror. A cold dew covered my forehead. My teeth chattered, and every limb became convulsed. He's now like the creature. He wakes up. He's disoriented. See how brilliant this is? It's sublime. And when by the dim yellow light of the moon, as it forced its way through the window shutters, I beheld the wretch, the creature now comes upon him, and they reverse roles. I beheld the wretch, the miserable monster whom I had created. He held up the curtains of the bed, and his eyes, if they may be called, were fixed on me. That is sublime. It transports you out of yourself. Sublimity, flashing forth at the right moment, scatters everything before it like a thunderbolt. Everyone who reads Frankenstein remembers that passage because it's like a lightning bolt out of a clear blue sky. Security guards at the Galleria dell'Accademia in Venice, where I was just a week ago, know me by name. Oh, gosh, he's back. And they like have to physically remove me from the presence of Giorgione's The Tempest. How many of you know this painting, The Tempest, Il Tempesta? By Giorgione. It's painted in 1506. And it's another example of sublimity. How do you paint a thunderstorm? How do you capture, this is the photograph of a thunderstorm. How do you capture the light coming from behind? And somehow or another, Giorgione, in this very strange, very mysterious painting, seems to capture that. The longer you look at this, the harder it is, the more difficult it is, the more impossible it is to look away. And everybody writes books about this. Oh, well, obviously, this is a representation of the Holy Family. You got Joseph and you got Mary and you got baby Jesus. Well, why are they trying to get out of a Tuscan town during a thunderstorm? I mean, they're not Italians. Right? And how is it that he gets it to make it look like the trees are moving in the breeze of this impending summer storm in the Tuscan villa countryside here? And how does he capture the light back there? And it's impossible to reproduce something like this in PowerPoint, especially when you don't have the right kind of lighting. But if you go to Venice, it's worth it to buy the plane ticket, go to Venice, have a really nice seafood pasta dinner, and then go look at this one painting until they drag you away from it, because you will fall into it. It is like a vortex. Right? Think about Shakespeare's play, The Tempest. How many of you have read his play, The Tempest? It's not based on a painting. It's a completely different kind of thing. And it's magical. It transports you into an entire another world where beautiful young Miranda, whose father, Prospero, is a magician, and he's been banished to this island, and he kind of rules over the island magically, and he brings about a tempest that causes the ship to wreck that has all the bad guys. They're always Italians in Shakespeare's English plays. The Italians are the bad guys, of course, right? And Miranda meets the first man that she's ever seen other than her father, which is what all of us who have one daughter, which I do, should probably do. Just make sure they never see another man except you until the right guy walks by on a ship that you caused a wreck on your magical island. That would be like perfect idyllic parenthood for daughters, especially in Los Angeles. She sees the first man. What does she say? Aldous Huxley uses the title of his novel. Oh, brave new world that has such creatures in it. That is sublime. And you read that and you will remember that your whole life. Right? And you want to talk about sublime. The David. Every time I take people through museums in Europe, especially in Italy, you know, I'll start off with 10 or 20 students. And then, you know, as we go through, you know, I notice, where did these other people come from? They're like a free guide. I should get like a little money changer. All right, that's going to be $1 because I talked about this painting here, right? And so this German guy comes up to me. He's obviously German. He's like wearing lederhosen and dress shoes. He's standing there, you know, looking for a country to invade, right? Okay. And so he's standing next to me, and he's got this big meerschaum pipe, you know. They put the pipe out there. Oh, I'm German. I can do whatever I want to, you know. Right? And he's standing next to me. He's got this big beard he's stroking, and he's listening to me talk. And I've got my daughter there, and he's like 15, 14 years old at the time. She was 14. She's in ninth grade. And you know, we're kind of talking about the experience of seeing it, you know. And the German guy says, I would like to ask you a question. And I'm like, who are you? I would like to ask you, yeah, certainly, sir. What can I help you with something? He's like, yeah, I'm wondering. I've seen this statue many, many times. I'm just curious. Now, remember, my 14-year-old daughter standing there. I'm just curious. I said, David, it's not circumcised. I'm like, I'd like you to meet my daughter. You've seen David many times, and that's what's on your mind? He's not circumcised? You understand, Michelangelo's David is not David. He's not Jewish. David is actually Florence. Every artist in Florence painted, drew, and sculpted a David. Some of them did it several times. Verrocchio and Donatello and Michelangelo. They all did a David because David was a symbol of Florence. Because Florence was very rich, but it was very small in the 14th and the 15th century, right, 16th century. It was very small, and they were constantly being attacked by Lucca and Pisa, and particularly the Duchy of Milan, up to the north. The Milanese would come down, we're taking you over and all of your money from all the great wool that you sell. Right? And so the Florentines, even though they were very small and not militarily powerful, eventually beat back Milan, the city-state of Milan. They were kind of like their own free republic, right? And so their symbol for themselves was David. Right? They're not Jewish. They were, you know, kind of Catholic, Christian, humanist scholars and artists at that time. But what is really interesting is that this image of David is not like the other images of David. Michelangelo brought it to the more dramatic moment. Instead of having, you know, the usual iconography is David is standing there and Goliath, you know, head with a rock in it is under there and he's, you know, standing there with his, you know, his sword or whatever, helmet's down there. Here, Michelangelo decides, nope, I'm going to get David in the moment when he's got the rock in the hand, right? See, he's got that rock in that right hand. He's got the sling over here and he's looking at Goliath going, you... What does he say? Uncircumcised Philistine. You understand how weird this sculpture is now? You uncircumcised Philistine. All of the people in my army are afraid of you. They're all turned to stone in front of you because you're so huge. Just like when you stand in front of the statue, you're turned to stone. You are astonished. You are astonied. So when you stand in front of Michelangelo's David, the question becomes, how did Michelangelo use a stone to turn you, the little guy, into a statue in front of his gigantic Goliath David? That's sublime. That is sublime. How about Parmigianino's little self-portrait in a convex mirror? Very famous painting from 1524. Brilliant. Italian, kind of Baroque mannerist artist, right? And he does, as all artists do, so artists' self-portraits are always the most interesting kind of things they do. And his almost distorted hand and his slightly distorted face are painted in this convex mirror. Artists are fascinated with mirrors because mirrors reflect, but they always distort at the same time. And so Parmigianino takes that effect and he shows the artist recreating himself and yet he is distorted. Talk about the suppression of truth. How about, I happen to think Citizen Kane is art. I think film is art, written and published on it. How about the final scene, almost final, almost penultimate scene in 1941, Citizen Kane by Orson Welles, who, like Michelangelo, was a genius who produced his greatest work as his first work at the age of 24, and Citizen Kane was booed at the Oscars, and it's now considered the greatest film of all time. Right? In the very end, when Charlie Kane walks out of his mansion, his whole life having collapsed around him, and he walks past two sets of parallel mirrors. Is there anything stranger and more sublime than parallel mirrors? I love parallel mirrors, right? I like getting, you know, the cabinets in the bathroom, line them up and get in there and go, goes off into the distance. But it always curves away, and I was going like this. You all probably never do that, right? Right? Because it's a picture of the infinite. If you were to put two mirrors next to each other and not get in between them and obscure it, what would there be to see? A reflection of 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 a reflection. How about the Wachowski brothers movie, The Matrix, which has the Alice in Wonderland imagery of going through the looking glass, going through the mirror. Or Christopher Nolan's fabulous scene, which is also, you know, it's kind of an action adventure movie, but it's also art in a certain sense, philosophical film art. How about the idea of bringing the parallel mirrors together underneath of an elevated train in Paris, where it goes off into infinity? And if we had 5 hours, we could talk about Diego Velázquez's Las Meninas. Just go look this painting up if you're not familiar with it and try and understand what is going on. Velázquez paints himself off to the left side. And so the painting that maybe he's painting, you see the back of the canvas, but he's looking at you, looking at him, painting you, or is he painting somebody else? And all the way in the very back, that guy in the doorway, or is that a doorway? Is that a painting of a guy in a doorway, because everything back there is framed. And then just to the left of the guy in the doorway or on the painting in the doorway, there is either a painting or a mirror of the people that he's painting in the painting. You understand? That's sublime. It is disorienting. How about Caravaggio's Medusa? He actually painted this twice, and the first time he did it, he reproduced it later because it was such a famous painting. Italian poet Gaspare Mirtola wrote, "Flee if your eyes are petrified in amazement. She will turn you to stone." Because you know the story of Perseus and Medusa and so on and so forth, right? And Caravaggio's great mannerist painter, 17th century, late 16th, early 17th century painter, paints the face of Medusa on this wooden shield, right? Because that's the story, right? Medusa sees her reflection in Perseus' polished shield, and she's turned to stone by seeing herself in the shield. Her head is cut off, and now her reflection, which is burned into the mirror, becomes his greatest weapon. Perseus comes up to you. He doesn't need to unsheathe his sword. He says, "Take a look at the shield." And you know that in almost all of his paintings, Caravaggio paints, whether it's a biblical scene like Paul getting knocked off his horse, or whether it's a mythological scene like this, Caravaggio makes it a self-portrait. That's Caravaggio, a guy, homosexual guy, painting himself as Medusa, the Gorgon with the head of snakes, who's frozen at her own image, and all the blood is rushing out of her head, which has been detached from her body. That is sublime. Other things that are very powerful to look at with your students would be paintings like Vermeer's The Love Letter or The Girl with a Pearl Earring, where the entire world of the painting focuses on this incomparably beautiful girl. You can't tell if she's 11 or 40. She's just beautiful. And she's looking right at you, and she's got this massive pearl earring here that reflects her and the painter and the entire room in it. And that is sublime. It's disorienting. How many of you do not have this hanging in your classical school on the wall somewhere? Right? Oh, you have to have that to join ACCS. What? You don't have Raphael's School of the Athens, School of Athens hanging on your wall? Oh, we can't let you into ACCS. Okay? And everybody knows Plato on the left pointing up, Aristotle on the right pointing down, and Plato is modeled after Leonardo da Vinci and some of the different artists here, like the guy kind of down and left a little bit, the white robe who's looking at you, that's Raphael Sanzio. And then all the way on the far right, we see this guy here on the ground. He's usually identified as Euclid, and he's bent over, and he's got a compass and chalk, and he's doing kind of an architectural design drawing. And that is Bramante, who is the artist who designed this building, which is called St. Peter's, the Vatican in Rome. And that is the building of the School of Athens. And this painting is on the wall of the Stanza di Signoria, the Signatura, in the Vatican. In other words, you go in the Vatican, you come around the corner, whoa, there's the School of Athens, a fresco on the wall by Raphael, who's painted into the painting, right? And Bramante, who designed the building I'm in, is there inside of the building, inside of the building, inside of the building, inside of the building, and that's the aporia, that's the confusion, that's the disorientation, that's the irony, that's the astonishment of the sublime. These experiences are actually, they're not just aesthetic experiences, they're theological experiences that transport you beyond yourself, like being in an old growth forest or climbing Mount Everest, or surfing in the Pacific on a warm evening. Self-transport is a key moment in the apprehension of the good and the true and the beautiful and ultimately the God of all things. Right? Just like nature is the echo of a great soul. Now, last thing I want to say to you is this. Most modern education appears to be designed to produce students who are ambivalent, cynical, detached from a world of beauty and transport. Los Angeles Unified School District, which is the area where I live, largest school district in the country, 9 years ago removed the capstone 12th grade literature course, British literature. You graduate from the largest school district in the country again and you will never be exposed to British literature. Not one. Instead, you get a subscription to the LA Times and once a week you write a personal response piece to any article that you read. That's 12th grade literature in Los Angeles. No Shakespeare, no John Donne, no Shelley. The LA Times. Teachers have a drive to aim for clarity and to end confusion and disorientation of their students. Stop it! Disorient them! Overwhelm them with beauty! Let them experience the sublime, put something up on the screen that they can't begin to understand, and then leave the room. They want you to explain it. Oh, explain it. If you explain it, you ruin it. Let them experience the sublime. This is a deeply theological and humbling experience. Now, I'm going to read to you the most sublime thing that I've ever read. It's my favorite verse in the Bible, Hebrews 5:8. And it's not just a perfect sentence. It's the most beautiful and sublime idea and image we can ever come across. Though he were a son, yet learned he obedience by the things which he suffered. Jesus had to learn obedience. He had to learn obedience through suffering. Though he were a son, yet learned he obedience by the things which he suffered. Give your students the experience of the sublime. Thank you.